Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. When there's a lake in your life, it's almost like having a relative. Lakes bring humans up close and personal with nature. A lot of fun happens on and in a lake. And for some, it's all about fishing. For others, it's water skiing, sailing, kayaking, paddleboarding, or maybe just sitting right there along the shore and taking it all in quietly. And for most, just being in the presence of a body of water, maybe around a bonfire at lake's edge, looking and listening to what's going on around you, that's just good for the soul. People are passionate about lakes. Mike Holdren certainly is. That's why the Tate's Creek High School arts teacher and avid tournament bass angler is publishing a book that honors the 100th anniversary of the creation of Harrington Lake, spanning Mercer, Garrett, and Boyle counties. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Well, thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. Glad to be here.
And so if you would take us back to that time between 1900 and 1925 and some of the key events that led up to the creating the first large reservoir in Kentucky.
Correct. I think as historians, we live with one eye in the rearview mirror, always trying to imagine what things were like. And if you can imagine a tri-county area of Boyle and Garrett and Mercer just blanketed with a deciduous forest, no roads, no neighborhoods. The only waterways that people either navigated or recreated along were small creeks, potentially the Kentucky River, but in small natural ponds. And the Dix Valley was a very deep valley, and it wasn't very accessible by foot. I mean, it was very precarious. So to suddenly, within about a quarter of a century, and notably between 1920 and 1925, where it really accelerated, to have Lewis Butler Harrington, by way of Albany, Georgia, he comes to Richmond to go to school and then gets a law degree as well, to create this dam basically in and around Bergen and fill up a 25-mile stretch of the Dix River, a 300-foot drop of a canyon. It was extraordinary. I mean, it must have seemed, you know, like a fantasy. Lewis gets to Richmond. We're not exactly sure why he left Albany, but he marries into the Hume family. The Hume family were distillers and very affluent. They also owned an electric business. He's got a law degree. He's practicing law in Richmond. Harrington was very charismatic. He was a great leader. He brought people around him that knew how to get things done. And I demonstrate this throughout chapter one in the book, so we don't want to go too deep into that. But suffice it to say, he also ran for an elected office and became a state representative of Madison County, a two-term. And suddenly, as a lawyer, a politician, an amateur geologist, and being the president of an electric company, which was bequeathed to him from his in-laws, he sees the future of electrical current in the 20th century.
And so the light bulb that went off was hydro.
No pun intended, exactly. Because the only thing that existed in Kentucky prior to that, and I'm paraphrasing Marilyn Thomas, hydro engineer in Frankfort today, who is oversees the history of this and dams in Kentucky. The only thing that we really had in Kentucky at that time were single-engine turbines along small rivers that might power a very small community up on the bank. And now, you know, you've got a fella that is envisioning a massive dam of incredible proportion and then a large hydroelectric facility to run electrical current through the central Kentucky area, but about 125 to 150 mile radius from Bergen, it went to Louisville. They were planning to go to in the southwest to Bowling Green, Pineville in the southeast, Maysville in the northeast, as well as Lexington. So that's what he was thinking about, and I credit him for being a visionary entrepreneur as well.
So it sounds like your classic game changer for the region.
Absolutely, because you know now you've vaulted the entire rural central Kentucky area into the 20th century with electricity, which a lot of people, it was by lantern. And it must have been exciting, you know, and just almost unimaginable. And I think that that's why the story is important, because this affected central rural Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a champion of that because, as you and I have discussed, I've been an outdoorsman for 5.5 decades. And that rural landscape, which is typically prior to this, pastoral and romanticized, and it has all those great aesthetic and spiritual qualities, now is becoming very functional. You know, you start to make the leap to encampments, roads, neighborhoods, businesses, a real estate market. It goes on and on and on and on. This changed everything, as you said, in a heartbeat.
And is it still pumping out hydroelectric power?
Those turbines still work today.
Well, from 22 to 23, Kentucky Hydroelectric and Dix River Power bought more than 90 additional water and land rights in that Tri-County area, all to accommodate the dam. Were there difficulties in obtaining those rights?
The first piece of land that Harrington purchased was December 21st, 1911. That was Charles Kennedy's Mill, Kennedy's Mill, where Kennedy Bridge is today, right there at, between Bergen and Buena Vista, where Kennedy Marina floats today. And from there, he went on to purchase through Dix River Power. That was his company. He sold the electric company in Richmond. He incorporates Dix River Power. Kennedy, Harvey Chenault, and others become officers of the company. And yeah, he's off to the races. He's snapping up land as much as he can afford. And then once they get close to 22 and 23, they make a massive sweep of the upper part of the Dix River, 20-some miles away in complete Boyle County. They established the 760-foot water line. And to answer your question, yes, there were eminent domain rights that were being contested by farmers and the like, and what happens if it floods and so forth. And those records are, I found them. I can't say whether anything untoward or malicious came out of all that, other than it was just litigation and information spreading through the court system to ensure the farmers that they wouldn't lose their land, or how much could they lose. It's beyond that, I'm not aware of a lot.
How deep is it at its deepest?
Well, it's the deepest lake in the state of Kentucky. If you go to Paducah, to Kentucky Lake, 160,000 acres, average depth 15 feet. Harrington is only just shy of 3,000 acres at full pool or a little bit higher, average depth 78 feet. And you can still find 200 depths today. I've got sonar recordings that I printed out, and they're in Chapter 6 to prove this. And you can leave the dam and travel 16 and a half miles away from the dam to Gwin Island, and it's still 110 feet.
Now, I know you're a tournament bass angler. Is Harrington stocked with bass?
Yes. It was noted from the time that it opened in 25 to the public and reached its first summer pool about a year later. For bass, that would include largemouth, spotted bass, and smallmouth bass. Also, famously for white bass, which migrated up the Dix River, and people came by the thousands to fish for those from as far away as Ohio and Michigan and Illinois. We have testimony of that from the Bryant's camp and the owners of that saw the license plates. Channel catfish, flathead catfish, and of course the notable hybrid bass, which is a cross between a striper and a white bass. They tried to introduce striped bass into the lake, but there's not enough current. There's just some biological things that the stripes didn't react to very well, but the hybrids are very hardy animals and have thrived there for a long time, and they're amazing. They're tanks if you catch one.
Well, a nice bass fillet in cornmeal can make for a mighty fine repast. Is it catch and release, or can you keep them?
You can keep. There's creel limits, just as there are at any reservoir in Kentucky. But most of the time, the fish that are kept are the hybrids. Then they're very good. They're very clean. They're very tasty.
So earlier I was talking about the love of a lake. When you become engaged with a lake, it's hard to get it out of your system. What part of the day would you say is your favorite time to be out there on the water?
Without a doubt, it's 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm still, even in the summer when I'm not at school, I'm just busy as a beaver, landscaping. It could be a number of things, but I get up early. That's when I went. I was introduced to that lake in the 70s with my father, and we went early in the morning, occasionally late at night to fish for white bass by lantern, but notably we went in the morning, and it's just always stayed with me. I fish from 6 to about 9 a.m. If I can't locate them then, I'm off the water. But the sunsets are extraordinary. I think I shared a few with you, and I've always got a camera ready. The fog, the great blue herons, which are notable on the lake, and, red-winged blackbirds and hawks and so forth. It's just, it's very peaceful. It's very passive. Nobody's really out there. I can have the lake pretty much to myself during a weekday in the summer, and the fishing is really good.
And a lake like Harrington could also be quite an economic driver for an area. I'm sure it's true in the case of Harrington.
Absolutely. I mean, as soon as the lake opened, they were selling plots of land. I've printed them in the book. Unfortunately, we can't go back in time to purchase land as cheap as it was then at $200 to $300 or $400 an acre. You got average price of homes, and that's between $300,000 and $500,000 now. I mean, that lakeside property down there is pretty pricey, but it has fueled communities that grew from camps. So you now have neighborhoods that extend back a half mile or a mile away from the lake. You've got small grocery stores, Dollar Generals and so forth, but among gas stations, and you've got the boating industry with Angler's Outpost. Stokely's Marine in Nicholasville is not too far away either. Marine Works is right there in Pandora. So there are several of them that just within arm's reach, literally, of the lake. And small restaurants, and most of the marine, well, there's nine marinas, but four or five of them have our full service with breakfast and lunch and dinners once we get past Memorial Day to Labor Day throughout the summer.
So, Mike, where can the book be found? And am I right that all profits from events that are associated with the book are pledged to the Harrington Lake Conservation League?
That's correct. I will be pushing the book out into the lake community and the Tri-County area at libraries, courthouses, and marinas. And at those venues or those events, when you find me there, I'll be signing and I want to meet people. And those profits from those book sales, whether it's 50 books or we sell 150 one night at a marina on a Friday night, you know, with a live band and everything else going on down there, all that money has been pledged to the Harrington Lake Conservation League. My wife is a former CFO and she's overseeing the endowment. So, yes, anything that when I'm peddling it and pushing it at anything where I am, it's just a nonprofit. And I told the publisher that, you know, royalties, you know, it's all going to go to the league. I said, don't put any incentives in that contract. This is more about providing history for the state of Kentucky than anything else.
As Mike Holdren, he is author of Harrington Lake, Kentucky's Marvel of Architecture, Water Power, and Nature. Thank you so much for coming in, Mike.
Tom, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Back in a few, when we'll go from lake to forest, namely the kind being used to reclaim old surface mine sites.
We're looking right now in Appalachia at about 1.2 million acres that needs to have something on it other than kudzu, briars, autumn olive, privet, all that kind of stuff.
And later in this hour, the powers of rhythm. And Kentucky's growing literary community.
There's something that's really going on right now in terms of hearing more voices, different kinds of voices from different parts of the state.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Cliff Drouet is a forester in the Office of Surface Mining in Lexington, and we've asked Cliff to fill us in on the Appalachian Regional Reforestation Initiative. That's an effort established back in 2004 to restore native forests and wildlife habitats on old surface coal mines throughout the Appalachian region. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Cliff.
Thank you very much.
And first, just a little bit of history about Cliff Drouet. How did you become a forester?
Well, that's pretty easy. I was in the Scouts. I grew up in South Louisiana, and I was in the Scouts, and I took forestry merit badge when I was about 12, 13 years old, and that lit me up because I went out to meet the parish forester at the scout camp north of Baton Rouge, and he brought us around, showed us trees, and then we did a prescribed burn on the scout camp, and I thought, man, they pay you, they give you a pickup truck, and you get to set the woods on fire. I'm on this. Save me a slot. So anyway, I went to Louisiana Tech School of Forestry up in North Louisiana. It's a small school with a big reputation for excellence. Graduated, went right to work as a procurement forester. Did that for 11 years and got the itch to go to work for myself, so I was a consulting forester for 25.
And then you went to work for the federal government.
That's true.
And so now we're here to talk about the Appalachian Regional Reforestation Initiative. So what is that?
We're restoring, Tom, old coal mines, surface mines, strip mines. People have different names for them. Mountaintop removal, all that. But anyway, what they've done is they've stripped off the top of the overburden, the soil and sandstone, limestone, and all that, to get down to that seam of coal. And then they dig that up, blast it, dig it. And then when they're through, reclamation, kind of the old school way, was push all the big rocks and the little rocks and all on top and kind of make it look like a Humpty Dumpty golf course, run over it a million times with heavy equipment, pack it as hard as your parking lot, and sow grass on it and leave. Well, that kind of worked for a while until you get a big rain, and then you got the Grand Canyon forming, and that's not good. So before the ARI initiative was started or the research was done, when I went into business for myself in 1991 in North Alabama, my home is there between Birmingham and Huntsville, and the top third of Alabama is southern Appalachian coal country. So I went to work for a coal company out of Jasper, Alabama, and they said, we're hiring you for 36 months. Your job is to figure out how to restore this better than sowing grass and get these mine inspectors off our tail. So I got with Auburn University and the Alabama Forestry Commission. I said, please help me. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm coming out of the log woods. I know nothing about this mining stuff. And so we started doing research, and we started. And the science, Tom, has gotten better. So now we're planting native species. We get in there first with a dozer with ripper shanks in the back and cross-rip it. It's like farming on steroids. Bust up that hard pan, hand plant bare root native seedlings, 1 year old. They're probably 16 to 18 inches tall, no bigger than a pencil. And we plant approximately 700 trees per acre on an 8 foot by 8 foot spacing. And we don't plant a row of pines and a row of, we don't do that. We try to make it as natural and as scattered out as possible.
And generally, what species of trees are you putting in there?
So in Appalachia, usually it's 85% hardwood and 15% pine. So in our hardwoods, red oak, white oak, hickory, persimmon, black cherry, wild plum, some chestnuts, some black walnuts, and the persimmon and black cherry and wild plum, those are for our wildlife species. We've do some silkwoods, some dogwoods. We put those in there because they're low bushy type of trees. They produce a lot of seed, and that's what you want. You want a good wildlife mix and a good long-living trees.
How much mine land has been returned to forests so far, and how much is left?
Let's go on that. How much is left? We're looking right now in Appalachia at about 1.2 million acres that needs to have something on it other than kudzu, briars, autumn olive, privet, all that kind of stuff. It's all invasive species, Tom. And now we've got that pear that's coming, the Bradford pear. All right. So we're trying to get rid of those, plant the other ones back. So the ARI program came about in 2004, the following spring of 2005 was the first planting time. So since that time, in 20 years, we've planted probably a 500,000 acres. So we've got a little over a million left to go. That's job security. We'll knock that out. But and this is on public land, private land, timber company land, University of Kentucky land. If it's mine site, I'll try to help you.
There's been some research conducted by, among other places, University of Kentucky, that's found a connection between that barren land that you were talking about and that those invasive species and the runoff that can result in some pretty serious damage downstream or downhill.
Correct.
So does this reforestation slow down that runoff?
Absolutely. So I call these barren mine lands, I call them moonscapes because that's about what they are. Very, very little topsoil. What's on it is what we call spoil, which is subsoil, rock, coal, mining debris, anything else. Okay. So by planting trees, you're establishing roots. When we cross-rip that hard-packed ground, that water can only run downhill from this rip or this furrow to this one. That's only 8 feet. So there is no sheet erosion. So we have addressed that immediately. And after the second year, those trees are dropping leaves, and that's creating a new soil layer and a duff layer, and that's stopping any water from rushing.
Speaking of water, how are you working to improve water and air and soil quality, for that matter, on these old mine sites?
Well, by planting the trees, once the first year that you plant your trees in early spring when it's cold, everything's dormant. So when those trees bud out and pop leaves, they're producing clean air. And their roots are going to grow for about 2 to 3 years. You're not going to see a lot of growth upward because the tree is putting all its energy into producing a root system. So you're dropping leaves. That's a new soil layer that's building. And by doing that, any water that perks through those leaves is a natural filter. So now your water's being filtered. It's perking down through the rock and all to get down to revigorate those springs. So now you've got clean air, clean water, and a new soil layer being built. To me, that's fantastic.
So for a landowner, there's an opportunity to get into carbon credits here. Do you have any expertise on that? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
I'll tell you what I know, which isn't a whole lot. So I'm not a carbon expert guy. I've taken a lot of these little short courses. But the thing that I'm asked constantly is, are you doing carbon credits? And my answer is no. I'm a government forester. We can't get involved in that. But there are several of our partners, Tom, are in the carbon credit business, I'm gonna call it. And they are doing a verification of the ARRI program so that it will be verified. Then those volunteer carbon credits can be sold. But that would be a deal between the landowner and one of the carbon credit brokers. So I'm out of that business.
Mm-hmm.
My job, Tom, is to get the trees in the ground, make sure they're surviving and growing, and leave it between the landowner and whoever they want to do business with.
Right. Okay. Well, now, I know you have partnerships with the White Oak and Longleaf Pine and Shortleaf Pine initiatives, and you refer to these partnerships as a true win-win for landowners, the environment, and ensuring the quality white oak logs for the future. Tell us more about that.
Okay. So the longleaf pine, we're out of the range pretty much up here for longleaf. Shortleaf pine, we're dead in the middle of it. So shortleaf pine does well in this part of Appalachia. You get a little further north of here, and you start getting into eastern white pine. So we're right where the two regions where they blend. The White Oak Initiative, if you put the white oak growing range over the Appalachian region, it's an exact match. So we're in the heart of white oak now. The White Oak Initiative was started in 2017 because, believe it or not, the distilling business knew, oh my gosh, we're going to run short of white oak because you can only use a charred bourbon barrel one time.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been planting trees since 1991. On mine sites, but the older white oaks are being cut at a very quick pace. So now the White Oak Initiative not only encourages people to plant white oak, that's what I'm doing, but to also manage your white oak wisely. So cut out invasive trees or competing trees around those white oaks so they can grow and drop more acorns. And that's what people are doing. So between planting trees and managing your trees wisely, those two spectrums should meet.
Are you looking for more sites?
Absolutely, every day.
And if somebody is listening to this and they are thinking, well, I've got that kind of property, how can they get in touch with you?
I have a work phone number, and that's 303-549-7249. That rings my work cell phone. And my email address is cdrouet@osmre.gov.
Cliff Drouet is a forester in the Office of Surface Mining in Lexington. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Short ones with great big roots. I like the ones that bend in the wind and the ones that got fruit. Whoa, trees, nice enough to see.
Coming up after the break, Empower Rhythm and Kentucky's new poet laureate. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Trees probably smarter than me and you.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Silas House has been a literary ambassador for the state as Kentucky Poet Laureate these past couple of years. His term has come to a close, so we invited his successor to stop by for a chat with Eastern Standard contributor Tom Eblin.
Kathleen Driscoll is an award-winning poet, essayist, and teacher, and she is Kentucky's new state poet laureate. Driscoll has published 6 poetry collections, and her poems have appeared in the nation's leading publications, including The New Yorker and The Southern Review. She is a professor of creative writing and chair of the Naslin Mann Graduate School of Writing at Spalding University in Louisville. An Oldham County native, she chaired the board of AWP, one of the nation's leading organizations for creative writers, from 2019 to 2022. Kathleen Driscoll began her 2-year term as Kentucky's Poet Laureate on April 24th, and she is here today with us to talk about her plans as Poet Laureate. Kathleen, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
What does it mean to you as a Kentuckian to be chosen by the governor to be Kentucky's Poet Laureate?
Oh, my goodness. It means everything. I mean, I've spent decades writing about Kentucky and connecting with other Kentucky writers and, you know, on a national platform trying to amplify the other writers in the state. So I'm thrilled. I'm delighted.
Well, every Poet Laureate has some projects that they want to do to promote literature and reading in Kentucky. What do you have in mind?
I do have quite a few things. I need to stay focused. There's so many things that I want to do, and I know that 2 years will go very, very quickly. So one of the things I'm really passionate about is going into high schools. So I'd like to Zoom with high school creative writing classes or writing classes, and I'd also like to read with writing teachers. I think it's important for students, especially high school students, to see their writing teachers as actual writers. So if anybody out there would like me to do that, I'd be happy to talk about that and try to schedule as many visits as I can. I love the outdoors. There's a park near my house that I love very much and figures in my writing. There's a huge park. One park is linked to another. It's called the Parklands in Louisville. And so they're helping me to pilot it's going to be called Walk and Write with the Kentucky Poet Laureate. Mm. So we'll go on one of the moderate hiking trails and, you know, sort of look around and take deep attention to things.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, and then come back into their beautiful facilities and write poems, or at least the beginnings of poems. So we know from the ancients that writing and walking in nature really helps us with creativity and our imagination. So I'm looking forward to doing that. That's always worked for me. I end up writing a lot of things or making notes when I'm out hiking. I'm working with the Youth Poet Laureate, some of those programs. I'm going to be reading at the Carnegie Center with the Lexington Youth Poet Laureate in August.
Oh, great.
Yes, and I'm also working with the Kentuckiana Youth Poet Laureate program, which is sort of a fledgling group. They're trying to get their program up and on its feet, and that's helps kids write poems from the Louisville and Southern Indiana region. So I hope to do more of that.
Great. Well, what else?
I'm working with the Arts Council, starting to work on maybe developing a podcast. I want to maybe share information that's happening around the state with other writers. I'm very fond of saying that every good thing that's ever happened to me in my writing life or my life in general has happened through a connection with another writer. And I know how important it is, particularly for people when they're just beginning to start writing, to make those connections and learn more. And one thing leads to another, leads to another. I just found that to be so true, not only in my life, but my students' lives as well. You know, maybe I'll have people on to talk about writing. Kentucky is such a rich place for writing right now. I know we've always had a wonderful tradition that we're proud of Kentucky writers, but there's something that's really going on right now in terms of hearing more voices, different kinds of voices from different parts of the state. And what I love about Kentucky, too, is its landscapes are so different, mm-hmm. which really colors, you know, from the prairies of western Kentucky to the hollers of eastern Kentucky.
Tell us a little about your most recent book of poetry, The Goat-Footed Gods.
Yeah. Well, that comes from the fact that I live in a place on the eastern edge of Jefferson County that has a lot of lore in it. And my husband and I bought an old country church that was built before the American Civil War. And we've been rehabbing it for years. And it's a wonderful place. It's an old post and beam building, but it's right next to a graveyard. And so for years, we've been chasing kids out of that place. But there's also down the hill, the most famous part of our neighborhood or community is the Public Trestle. I live on Public Road.
Mm-hmm.
And the Public Trestle, the goat man is supposed to live there. And if unfortunately, it's terrible, it's tragic. He's some teenagers, early young adults, legend trippers, they call mm-hmm. them, I found out, believe that if they go in the middle of this trestle, and it looks pretty old and decrepit, but a train comes through 3 times a day. And if they go in the middle of the trestle, then they can summon the goat man. And there have been 5 fatalities on that bridge. So the goat man is known said in the Washington Post that he is the most lethal cryptid in America because he has actual deaths attributed to him. Mm. So a young girl lost her life doing that, going to the middle of the bridge and getting knocked off by a train in 2019, I think. And I just could not get her out of my mind. Mm-hmm. And there's a little memorial there. I walk my dog by it. And so, you know, there, in no way am I suggesting that my grief is anywhere near her family or friends. I didn't know her. But it's affected me mm-hmm. and our community. And so I started thinking about that. And then my daughter in 2020 had a traumatic accident. She was on her best friend's deck, second story deck that collapsed. And she had she has an incomplete spinal cord injury. And so I'm thinking about falling and, you know, and also, although the book is about more than this, but also I wonder why it is we believe we need to conjure up monsters mm-hmm. and things to be afraid of in the world. I'm not a person that's really afraid of being out in the world. I'm probably too brave sometimes, but I do know that things happen unexpectedly. It's happened in my life, and I just the whole idea of why is it that we need to do this, you know? So those things are working pretty heavily in the book thematically, but there are other things too.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. The Poet Laureate's office is through the Kentucky Arts Council. So how could – you mentioned that you are interested in doing school visits and things. Mm-hmm. How should someone get in touch with you?
Well, you can go to the Kentucky Arts Council webpage, and you'll find – if you sort of scroll around or click around, you'll find me there as mm-hmm. part of their programming. But you can reach me at Kathleen at KathleenDriscoll.com, and that's where I'm taking emails for – you know, interviews and events and things like that. So my last name is spelled kind of funny. It's D-R-I-S-K-E-L-L. But, you know, you could Google Spalding Kathleen Driscoll and you would come up with it. I'm pretty easy to find, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Spalding, and low residency MFA programs have become very popular mm-hmm. For creative writing in recent years. And Spalding has one of the nation's leading ones from what I hear. Who is that program for, and how does it work, basically?
Well, a low-residency program, I'll tell you the way ours works. You come and you take a course, a residency course, and you're there for a week. But, of course, I always tell students the residency course is much more than the residency, so there's a good deal of intensive preparation. But you come to Louisville, you come to campus. We also have a virtual residency that we're going to start in about a week or so. Mm. So you can take your residency then. And then there are workshops and lectures and readings. It's almost like a boot camp for writers. It's wonderful. And then you are paired with a mentor and you work one-on-one with that mentor through the semester and you trade work. And then that mentor is really focused on your work and what you want to achieve. I'm not really interested in, you know, laying the Spalding aesthetic over writing. We're always trying to figure out what students want to achieve and try to help them do that. But our students, we expect them to write a lot, and they get better very, very quickly.
That sounds great.
Yeah, our average A student is 44. Mm-hmm. These are folks who have done what they were supposed to do, went and got their degrees that their parents wanted them to get, but they've always had an itch to write, and now they're at a place, you know, where they can come away and do that. So it's a very passionate group of writers that we have.
My guest today has been Kathleen Driscoll, who recently became Kentucky's Poet Laureate for 2025 and 2026. If you would like to reach out to her, she can be contacted through the website of the Kentucky Arts Council. Kathleen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's the sound of Empower Rhythm at a recent performance in Lexington, with more of those to come this summer. Co-founder Leslie Stamatis joins us with details. Leslie, first, a little bit of background. What is Empower? And by the way, for the listener, that's spelled with a capital M, apostrophe P-O-W-E-R.
Yeah, so we are a youth percussion program. We focus on African drumming, both instruction and performance, for youth ages 5th through 8th grade. Although once they join with us, they can stay with us on through high school and beyond if they choose.
What is it about rhythm and drumming in particular that kind of works as a medium to bring young people together?
We focus on African polyrhythms. And what Tripp teaches right out of the gate is how different parts have to fit together together to create the whole sound. And it can be someone playing a more basic part along with somebody playing complicated parts, and they all fit together. They work together. It's very much about teamwork and collaboration and communication and listening.
And you mentioned Tripp there, and you're referring to a heavily in demand drummer and percussionist in these parts, Tripp Bratton, who's a big part of Empower. Tell us more about his role.
Yeah, so Tripp Bratton is an amazing Lexington multi-instrumentalist composer, arranger, producer, video and recording artist, arguably one of the most sought-after drummers in Lexington, recent Lifetime Achievement Award winner, the Lexington Music Awards. The thing about Tripp that is so cool, I think, is that he's an equally good music educator. He's been teaching for many, many, many years in all different venues, from schools to camps to he's at Berea College, has been at Center College up until this past year. So he is a co-founder of Empower Rhythm.
And you have a couple of other people working with you. One of them is a fairly recent immigré from Haiti trying to get away from all the violence there. He's a professional dancer, Wislin Paulias. Tell us about him.
Wislay was a true professional in Haiti, had his own dance company, dance studio, is a professional Haitian dancer and drummer. So he was looking for how to plug himself into our community and share his culture.
And finally, Gideon Alawarie, who's got a resume about as long as my arm. And it's really interesting. Give us a minute about Gideon.
It's just an interesting story about Gideon and the synchronicities of how Tripp and Gideon got linked up way back in the day. And he is from Ghana, master drummer, but he resides in the U.S. during the academic year because he's on faculty at the University of North Texas. He at least was at one time the only African tenured professor of African drumming and dance in the U.S. But he has this long history of a connection with Lexington. I think he lived in Lexington for a year residency way back when. He's been coming to Lexington regularly since the 90s, doing workshops and performances. And Tripp Bratton considers him one of his, you know, closest mentors.
I know he's also done some work along with Tripp with Lee Carroll and See the Beat and Green Room Exchange. So yeah, he's
been
around town.
Yes.
So it's been a couple of years now since you and Tripp founded Empower. Has there been enough time to see some outcomes?
Yes. Beginning to really build a family environment, a community. One of our day ones, we call him. We have two kids that have been with us since day one. Ian Johnson likes to say what he likes about Empower Rhythm is it forms a big family around you. We all come together like a family. And that's exactly what we're trying to achieve with our program.
So you've had a busy summer already in June with more to come, including some performances coming up in July. What's on the calendar?
Yeah, well, something we are really excited about, we are getting ready to do our own standalone premiere performance in July, and it's called African Seeds and Bluegrass Roots, and folks can expect drum, dance, song, and spoken word with this production.
And where is that happening?
That's going to happen at the Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center in the Black Box Theater on July the 11th and 12th. Two performances, both starting at 7 p.m.
Okay. And then am I right that you're also performing at the Tall Sound Reggae Fest in July?
Yes. They've asked us back. We were there last year. And we were so excited for it, and it rained like crazy. Mm. We still did our performance, but boy, just hardcore reggae fans who are willing to stand out in the rain. So we are super excited to go back to Reggae Fest because that has really turned into a big deal in our community. I think it's expanded to more of a reggae week.
Is Empower kind of unique to Lexington, or is it modeled on something else out there in the country?
Well, when I first asked Tripp the question, is there something you've always wanted to do that you haven't done yet that you need to help with doing? And he didn't hesitate 10 seconds. He said, yeah, I'd like to do a youth percussion program. There are two model programs right up the road in Louisville, the River City Drum Corps and the Louisville Leopards. And then we took to, as I'm used to doing, having worked in academia, I'm like, okay, well, we need to research what's going on all across the country. What are the model programs? And there are programs, you know, scattered across the country, all having their slightly different slant. So, you know, we're just trying to do it our way.
All right. That's Leslie Stamatis, co-founder of Empower Rhythm. Thank you so much, Leslie.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up next week on Eastern Standard, a question for the times.
Are we really just going to decide that we are going to be a divided country and there's going to be more than half of the population that we choose to not associate with? Are we going to divide off into factions in our society and not be truly America anymore?
Carissa Raskin will be the guest of Eastern Standard contributor Carolyn DuPont. She heads the Listen First Project, which works to bridge division. Thing is, according to research done by Dana Goldwaith-Young, Carolyn's second guest next week, we may not really be as divided as we've come to think we are.
When you actually drill down and ask them about their positions on issues, even things as seemingly contentious as guns or abortion, actually find a lot of agreement. And people say, are you sure that's true? That is empirically true.
We hope you'll join us next Thursday at 1 p.m. and 8 p.m., Sunday at 6 p.m. here on WEKU. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions are on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.